apologies for all that, and I just hope that it's worth waiting for. I will appreciate the fact that you have now your schedule is behind, and your dinner is waiting, and so is mine. But I will be trying to get through this, but without losing out much on it. I'll scoot through it, if you like. This is a presentation on a work that I did in February this year, and it was the first of a two-year project looking at what it turns out to be dinosaur breeding grounds in the Middle Triassic some 235 million years ago in the southern part of Argentina in the Patagonian area that has recently been... It was found about in 1950s, the first evidence of juveniles in that area, and this is the next trip, the only trip since the 1950s that we've gone back to try and relocate the place where juvenile dinosaurs were found in an effort to confirm that it is in fact a breeding ground for dinosaurs way back in the Middle Triassic. To put you into the Middle Triassic paleogeographic context, that is now the Pangean times. There was all the continents were together in the Middle Triassic, and we are dealing with the southern part of Pangaea, which is known as Gondwana, and we are dealing with the western part of Gondwana down in this part of basically southwestern Gondwana. So you can get an indication now of how far this area, this region was from the paleo South Pole, which at that time was sitting in the center of, in this part of Antarctica. And of course in relation to Cape Town there, and interestingly, this part of Brazil up here. So we've got very good reasons to suspect that there was a good migration of animals around this part of Western Gondwana at this time. There was nothing stopping them going from South Africa to Patagonia and back. To just look at a little bit more detail at that connection then between the African Karoo Basin, the South African Karoo Basin there, and these large basins in South America, there was a large long mountain. In fact, there still is a long mountain range all the way along the southern edge of Gondwana, caused by the subduction, the crust here going down underneath the Gondwanan plate and creating a mountain land in this region here. And of course, we have the remnants of this mountain land right here along in Cape Town, and all our southern Cape Fold belt is part of this ancient Gondwanite mountain land. So these were creating a highland along here, and in the foreland, or in the inland part of it, because of the extra weight on the crust, the rest of the crust around that mountain was subsiding into basins, and these are the elongate basins into which rivers were flowing, and animals were living and dying, skeletons were being buried, and now they form basically what we know as the Karoo Rocks of southern Gondwana. And that's basically what I study. I study all those rocks and all those places, and my project extends all the way along the ancient foreland of southern Gondwana. In detail now, we are going down to a place in... these are little basins. These are rifts, basins, these purple things. And this is where little catchments of sediment and fossils have been caught, and we can now get at them and look at, see what they're like, little windows into what life was like in these parts of southern Gondwana in the Middle Triassic. That's the basin that we're going into now. I have been working in the Waterberg Basin in Namibia with Brazilians who were working in the Santa Maria Basin there, And recently we've just published a paper that shows an identical fossil, a big Dicynodont skull, that comes from Omingondi Formation in Namibia. And only other place it's ever been found is there. So it's another very nice indication that the reconstructions of our Gondwana reconstructions are very good. That the structures align, the sediments align, and now even the animals and the plants that were in that depression, in that rift valley, they also line up. Now a Google image of what it's like today. Of course, all this, the drift is still going on at about 3.4 centimeters per year. That's now the drift along the mid-oceanic rib. So Cape Town and Buenos Aires are moving away at about 3.4 centimeters per year. And at the moment, we are looking at a place like here. Buenos Aires is up here. So I had to get across here and then travel all the way down the coast to Buenos Aires. I had to travel by bus, mainly because there's a whole lot of volcanism going on, and they wouldn't allow the airplanes to land in this area because of volcanic dust, volcanic ash. It's nice to show Antarctica in the same picture. It sort of shows a little triangle here we've got going with Antarctica. And of course, I've been working down in the Transantarctic mountain lands right here in the Middle Triassic as well. So I've been looking at the animals here and the animals here, the animals in Omingondi in Namibia, and the animals here, and as well now as up in Brazil. So it's really quite a nice story developing as to when there was contact between these animals and when there wasn't. So when there wasn't is quite interesting, as well as the commonalities. The differences are just as important. Coming now to the southern part of into Patagonia as such, that's the area that we ended up. So I had to travel all the way down the coast and then inland across to this part of southern Patagonia. Patagonia is most well known, of course, for these lakes and the beautiful snow-capped mountains and ice fields up here. We were within the effect of the ice fields, although down on this flat wasteland sort of thing, it was bitterly cold and the wind blew, but we didn't get the advantage of the beautiful scenery. Buenos Aires, everybody who's been there knows Buenos Aires. This is Claudia Marsicano and Adriana Mancuso. They are two, she's a sedimentologist and she's a vertebrate paleontologist. We have worked together extensively in Argentina, in South Africa, and in Lesotho, and in Namibia. So she basically is a collaborator on most of this Western Gondwana program. And the National Geographic Society is the main sponsor of this particular expedition, so the National Geographical Society. We took, took the bus because the aeroplanes were not able to land at that time, and traveling down to this town called Trelew in the Chubut province in the northern part of Patagonia. This is basically a Welsh town settled by Welsh sheep farmers. It's still very Welsh in many respects. And the two nights we spent preparing for the field trip, we stayed at this touring club, which is like a blast from the past, the Welsh part. This is the dining room and the congregation room. It's a place where people come and drink coffee and chew the fat, so to speak. And this is a modern coffee urn from most beautiful sort of setting, really, for because of the very Welshness of the place. Interestingly and amazingly, right down there is a museum of paleontology that is devoted to the paleontology of Patagonia. It is quite amazing that in such a remote part of the world that there should be such a devotion to the paleontological record, far, far more investment in the paleontological record than South Africa has ever made. But this is a very, very nice museum. And obviously it's very modern and very well equipped. And they have a dynamic group of paleontologists, mostly vertebrate paleontologists, who are based here and have many students. So it was a very impressive institute. And interestingly, they too have a fossil park type place. We know the fossil park up on the west coast of Langebaan, based on Cenozoic deposits we have here. They too have a fossil park, geopark they call it, but also based on Cenozoic deposits close by. I unfortunately didn't get a chance to visit it this time, but I will do when I go back next next January, February. So that's on definitely on my agenda. They have a very good preparation laboratory, which we all know is the key to a good and flourishing paleontological program. You have to be able to clean these fossils. This one is open, viewable by the public, but of course it's some stupendous Patagonian dinosaur material. Most of this is Cretaceous, large Cretaceous dinosaurs that they are preparing in here, but state-of-the-art preparation material, microscopes and grinders, lighting especially very good, these optic fibers, and the extraction facilities are superb. So very state-of-the-art, and I am extremely envious of this facility. They also have an oversized facility, of course, which is great. We too need a facility for dealing with big fossils. This is a dinosaur in here, or part of a dinosaur. So this is the size of the jackets that they are coping with. But this is what I really needed to see first before setting off into the field, to see what Bonaparte, this chap who had discovered neon infants and eggs in this part in the 1950s. This is the specimen that he found, and there's a close-up of dinosaur eggs that he had brought. He also found, in association but not in the nest, he found remains of seven juvenile dinosaurs, which he named Mosasaurus, mouse lizard. These are the eggs, the three of them in contact, and where you see them, of course, in contact like this, and in this one below this one, but with the matrix in between. It's very good that they actually left the matrix in between, because this is the matrix that buried the eggs. The eggs are complete, whole, they haven't hatched as such, so they would be regarded as sterile eggs, although they were made sterile almost certainly by the covering material, the material that covered them and killed them, suffocated them. So I was very particularly interested in how these eggs were killed, if you like. So it is a clutch. The eggs are in contact with each other, so they are very definitely not transported into that mode. They were laid in that mode. So I'm quite satisfied that this is a dinosaur nest. Bonaparte described them, and this is he found juveniles and eggs, but he did not find any adults. No, so as yet, there is no adult Mosasaurus. All these fossils found so far are infants, and of course one of our projects was to find the adult. Find out what an adult Mosasaurus is like. This is what they've reconstructed the embryos. There's one of the embryos. Well, they're not embryos, they are infants. Neonates is the word we use, but basically infants. They are not just out of the egg, but they are still in an aggregation and almost certainly being nurtured by one or other adult one of the adults. We are now looking for the adults and looking to see if how much of this nurturing was going on. See if we can find evidence of the aftercare, if you like. The local museum will make a model of the infant Mosasaurus. And this would be the prosauropod. It's a prosauropod, and this would be the adult that they have not yet found. So the aims of the expedition were to find that late Triassic site and recollect it, if you like, to look at the paleoenvironmental setting. What was it like when these dinosaurs were laying their eggs, and why did they choose this site over any other to do that? to test the hypothesis that it was a breeding ground, that it, in other words, by that it means the dinosaurs were coming back year after year after year. They preferred this site to do breeding and this site over others, and to find more eggs and clutches, and to find more body fossils, find other animals if they were around, and who else was sharing this breeding site. So that's, they are the research questions that we went out there to find, and as I say, National Geographical Society has come up with 2 years of funding for this, which is very nice. They only fund expeditions, so with really good logistical support from the museum in Trelew, plus the students there, and Diego Pohl, who is the leader of this expedition. So, and this is Diego Pohl. He has put together a very good team with good field vehicle support and, of course, lots of coke, you know. So you can tell it's a student trip, you know. So the students did the shopping, obviously. That's Diego Pohl, and he's one of Argentina's top scientists. He lives in Trelew, and he is the curator of paleontology in that museum. Driving south from Trelew down towards the field area, one of the things you're struck with is its flatness, of course, but these little things in the felt every half kilometre or so are these things. These are the nodding donkeys of a gas field. This is a productive oil and gas field area, and it was sort of, I include this just to give you an indication of what the gas people can do to a landscape very similar to the Karoo if you let them go, you know. So there is a lot of warning signs. If you really want to know what fracking could do to the Karoo, just go to Google image of the southern Patagonia area. Just look at the tracks across the landscape done by the seismic lines and the pipelines, and it slices the whole place up into nice little quadrants, which are visible from space. So fracking is allowed in the Karoo. This is what it would be like. So the place is oil and gas mad. Everybody burns gas all the time. It's free to all the people who live around there, and this is their monument to the gas people. So it's a Petrobras, of course, is the predominant producer of this. Working further south now along, this is the Orca coastline. This is where lots of people come to photograph the killer whales. And this is, we unfortunately couldn't stop. But one thing that struck me all the time I was there was the sky. The sky looks like this pretty much all the time. You can see it's windswept, but it has this sort of high-altitude jet stream-type conditions almost all the time, and it's very cold, you know. So this is the typical skyline. It's very similar to Antarctica, but we don't get cloud like this in Antarctica. So it's on the fringe where cloud can form. It's still warm enough for cloud to form, let's say. That's a typical of the of the Patagonian scenery and the Patagonian skies. And the Patagonian rancheros, or basically the sheep farms, this is a typical Welsh sheep farmer's house. They still farm sheep in the area, and they still ride around in the imported trucks that they brought there. So we were based then on one of the farms and one of the estancias, and this one had been taken over by the gas people, and it housed geologists before we got into it. The geologists had left, but they did leave behind a satellite dish that, with the ingenuity of some of our students, they actually rigged up the satellite dish and actually managed to get an internet connection way out here. Quite incredible. This is where we were based, in this deserted farmhouse. And also very patriotic. They raised the Argentinian flag. We were based, well, we slept in cup tents outside in a wind behind a windbreak, and that's Claudia and Andrea trying to work out their pup tent with the sheep dogs basically that were in constant accompaniment, as well as pigs. Pigs were a real problem because they like to bask in the sun, and the best sunniest spots were always right against your tent. The pigs actually demolished one of the tents, so they were quite a problem. Interestingly, the horses are bred for eating out there. So horses, this horse was obviously butchered and now left for the scavengers. But this horse, when I saw this, I thought, well, you know, it won't be long. And of course, it wasn't long before horse turned up on the menu. So so I was able to show you what the horse looked like before it turned up on the menu. Just a little bit of the remnants of the geology that this is what a typical geological camp would leave behind. It's the core that they sink down to test the oil and gas, mostly gas in this area. And so these are all the core logs, the actual cores in core boxes are all nicely labeled, but just left now. And depending on the productivity of the area, then these will be kept, otherwise they'll just be left to go to rot. The same thing happens from the uranium cores in the Karoo. Many farms in the Karoo, you'll find similar stacks of core boxes just falling apart. We shipped out this vehicle because there are no roads going to where we wanted to get to. There was only these crisscross lines of seismic roads in about a kilometer square. We needed to get much more flexibility than just going on a grid system. So this is a very nice way of that's one of the seismic lines. This is a very nice way of getting off those tracks into the felt to do scouting, to really scout the area before we brought the other vehicles in. A lot of work with Google helped tremendously to find outcrops out there. We did know where the X came from Bonaparte's paper, and it comes from this little laguna, this little island or little hole in the bedrock. This is predominantly a bedrock. This is predominantly a bedrock area. You can see the layers of the bedrock up on end, and this is now a sink or a hole in that bedrock, and it's in there that the Middle Triassic rocks have been preserved. And if we get a bit further down, getting closer to it, that's the picture of the hole, and these sort of red rocks just around the edge of a modern, this is now a modern salt pan, and there's some red rocks protruding through the modern salt pan. That is the only outcrop that is exposed of these sediments, and it's in this corner here that the eggs that Bonaparte, that's where he found them. So we went back there and started to do some more work. This is the sort of view from the ground as you approach the laguna. It's the red in the center is not red rock. It is algae, basically, in the drying up succession of this playa, the arid zone lake. The rocks that we're interested in are actually exposed around the edge of it, these low-lying flat areas. This is a basement rock, entirely much, much older and of no interest to us at all. Down at Rachi at ground level, that's what it looks like across the pans. So the order of the day was really to walk and look and look and walk is the typical paleontological exercise. I had other jobs to do apart from that, but generally the first thing we needed to do was to find something worth logging. So, amazingly, of course, as happens, as we actually walked towards the laguna from our vehicles, which were parked behind us, towards the laguna, this chap picked up this piece of rock and found a bit of bone in it. And he took us to here, and Diego and I started to work around here, and lo and behold, started to find bones just beneath the surface, just in a most uninteresting, unpromising sort of place. You couldn't believe that there were actual fossilized bones just under the surface. So we started to work away at that, and you can see it's frigging cold. Everything, you cannot really help have your hands exposed.
How cold?
It's the wind. Wind is so cold. It's a wind chill factor of at least 10 degrees. So that although the sun is shining, anything you've got sticking out, your nose, your fingers, it's all really gets really cold, and it gets chapped. Wind chapped. But so as we worked around and around, these things started to develop, and took about a week or so of just uncovering. These are actually bones. I know they don't look that impressive at the moment. But then we found a skull here. This is actually a skull on the end of a vertebrae. These are vertebrae, and that's a skull. And as we kept clearing around the skull here, bumped into this thing. And this thing turned out to be another skull. So there are two skulls, two vertebrae, two animals lying nose to nose, lying like that, on the edge of this laguna and in an area which... nobody would have really looked as such. It was almost a chance encounter. But having done so, then, of course, we had much better search image, and we were able to to continue to uncover this. This is what keeps Argentinians going. Of course, it's mate. It is the drink of the day, and it's drunk almost every 10 minutes throughout the day. Without it, an Argentinian cannot function. And of course, it wasn't long before I started not to function without it. It is just it's a herbal tea, basically, but it's something they become addicted to. So it's very nice, and you drink it hot. You suck the water out from beneath this herbal concoction. Nobody ever can tell me what's in it, you know. I don't think anybody wants to know what's in it, but it is actually very nice. So there's a picture at ground level now of these large vertebrae. These are limb bones of this dinosaur. At the present, of course, it's a sauropod dinosaur that we can tell. We can tell that it's large. It could be the adult Mosasaurus. Until we see the skull in preparation, we will not tell whether it's Mosasaurus or another very large prosauropod dinosaur, such as Plateosaurus. Plateosaurus we find in South Africa. It could be similar to the South African form, or it might be the uniquely Argentinian Mosasaurus. But we have yet to prepare all this stuff out to identify. One of my jobs, let's say, is to do the taphonomic map. Taphonomy is the study of natural death and burial of these things. So to understand how these animals got to be where they are, you need to really study in detail the way they're lying, what they're lying on, how they're lying, and how weathered the bones are, how disarticulated the skeletons are, what the attitude is. Many, many factors that you would normally do a skeleton if you found it. A forensic investigation is similar to a paleo-forensic investigation of the dinosaur death site, if you like. So now you can get an idea on the two skulls there. It's lying right together, the disposition of the forelimbs, the spine, the hind limbs, the hips, and the same on this animal. So there's one animal lying this way, one lying both exactly the same horizon, the same place, the same time. They died together at the same time in the same place. So it's an interesting scenario of how this happened, and that, of course, is my job to unravel that. And this is done on a square meter grid. You saw the twine that I put over the dig, and then map it onto that. So there's the two skulls lying together. It's nice this because this actually checks my mapping as well. You see, because the photograph now exactly superimposes on those skulls. There they are, the two skulls. We have yet to lift this whole lot. The stuff is still out there. We didn't know we were going to find something like this, so obviously grossly under-resourced to excavate something like this, but at least we know how much work we've still got to do. That's now the skull of one of them with the cervical vertebrae going off that way. So that's an adult Mosaurus, if we ever thought. That's probably what it's going to look like, but whether it's Platysaurus or Mosaurus, we don't really know. But that's a typical quadrupedal pose for a large prosauropod. The news of this alerted the local CONICET, that's now the Argentinians NRF, if you like. They were so sort of excited by it, they sent a film crew down immediately, and within a day or so they got there, and they wanted to film the exhumation of these two dinosaurs. So they basically sat and filmed for two or three days whilst we finished off the excavation and did interviews with us all. And they're going to put a little documentary together to promote CONICET, the Argentinian science funding body. Close by, right next door to that dinosaur locality, there was this occurrence of these very peculiar nodules. These are calcareous nodules with this particular type of cracking, which is known as septarian shrinkage cracking, and it's an indication that the sediment at the time of this nodule was formed was alkaline, was in an alkaline condition, because that's what causes the calcium muds to shrink like this. It's a chemical shrinkage. It doesn't necessarily mean it's dry, it does mean it's alkaline. So these were all around the area and quite distinctive. So they are part of the story that was going here, that this area was an arid or semi-arid part of the world at that time, and that the sediment around this area, the sediment that actually buried these dinosaurs, was alkaline in nature. In other words, it wasn't a peaty bog, it wasn't acidic, it was definitely salty and dry and much more similar to these types of pans that we get today. So it started to become conceivable that maybe this environment has been going since the Middle Triassic. Another nearby salt pan. So now we got to the hang of looking into these scree areas. Most of this is nodular material that's come out of the rocks. And to walk these scree areas almost systematically back and forth, we started to find bones. And this bone, I found it, and it turned out to be particularly interesting because of this. This is not a sauropod bone. This is now the first time something else other than Mosaurus or sauropods have been found here. This is actually a theropod. Now, that's one of the carnivorous dinosaurs, and it's borne out by the thick wall of the limb bones. And we started to excavate this. This is just a few bones on surface. The rest of the skeleton is still in the surface. We've excavated enough to know that it is an articulated specimen of something which would be something in this order. This is a typical large theropod that is still lying there. Also has to be excavated in next year. On the same place where the theropod was up on this bank of the opposite bank of this laguna, in this bank there's a lot more fossil wood material coming out of the rocks, and you could see that there's very clear seasonal growth rings in it. So not only was it not only was it alkaline here at times, it was probably seasonally alkaline. So we had very strong seasonality, very strong salt pan growth at times, and at other times, obviously, much lusher, because we had it was able to sustain a very good herbivorous fauna. Well, let's have a look at the lushness of this vegetation by finding the right sort of rocks. This particular rock is a volcanic ash. This area was much closer to the Gondwanaid mountain belt, and that Gondwanaid mountain belt did have volcanoes at the time. So there were much more ash layers here, and of course we can use the zircons in the ash layers to date the rock with, and 235 is a very good date from these rocks. As well as the volcanic ash preserving a very nice plant material. This is a fern, very clearly a fern, known as Dicroidium. And these Neocalamites, this is a sort of equisetum or a horsetail-like plant that grew at that time. It was almost certainly one of the fodder foliage plants of the large herbivores. Very productive, lots of stems, lots of these little whorls of small leaves around a node in the stem. These are the nodes, very, very nice node. Look at the preservation on these is absolutely superb. I got really interested in these, and I excavated and made a little quarry of these. Unfortunately, I had to leave it all behind because my permit did not include plants. The Argentines are very strong on demarcating or division of labour. A vertebrate paleontologist is not allowed to look at these, so all I could do was find them, open them up, photograph them, and leave them behind. Beautiful stuff, though. This is Dicroidium. We find the same plant in the Maltino Formation in South Africa. Anywhere in the in and around Lesotho, you will find, in the South African area around Lesotho, you'll find these plants of the same age. We don't find any dinosaurs or any other vertebrate fossils associated with our plants here, but here's the plant, and we've got the vertebrates associated with it there. So now we can actually sort of hypothesize that these vertebrates could well have been in our Karoo Basin at this time. There may be a preservation bias, or they just didn't come into the Karoo Basin because it just wasn't there seen at that time. Something about the Karoo, Arkmay Karoo Basin, was inhospitable to the dinosaurs at that time. But they were certainly eating this stuff and living quite happily in the Patagonian part of it. We're going to go back now to the nesting site that Bonaparte had found. That was down on this laguna, and we then spent a lot of time mapping and doing. This is the actual site where Bonaparte had actually found some juvenile infants. Sorry, infants, not juveniles, infants in this little hole here, and we then spread out and completely covered this area, mapped it, did. Like centimeters by centimeter scouring off the surface, and found many, many more fossils. There's a typical fossil. There's a vertebral, articulated vertebrae of a small animal, a small dinosaur. You can tell it's a dinosaur. It's got long spondylus, cotton reel shaped vertebrae, and it's going into this calcareous nodule. It was documented, taphonomically mapped, hasn't yet been excavated. We've got lots of excavating stuff to do with a lot of equipment, but there's far more fossils then that could be excavated in the time available. But interestingly then, this little clutch came up. This guy found it again. He was the guy who found the big sauropods. And he came across some very small eggs. Now, clearly, they were much smaller than the eggs that I'd seen in Trelew. And there they are. They are at least they are half the size of the eggs in Trelew, and a little different in shape. but they are clustered and they are in a clutch, so it's in a nest. So there was something else nesting in that area, and we started to pick out a lot more variety in the eggs at that site. There's a nice clutch, another, but this is of the same size as Bonaparte had found and collected. There the two eggs are in contact with each other. There's the hole from which they came. Now I, of course, collect everything because the stuff that was covering them is, in fact, more important than the stuff that was laying in them. I want to know what caused these eggs not to hatch, if you like. It's trying to do a little bit of paleoforensics. There's more egg material here. And I'm just as interested in eggshell fragments as I am in whole eggs. This is, of course, the ones, eggshell fragments are the ones that did hatch. So I want to know where the eggs were most fertile in this system and where they were adult. So, there's a hatched egg, if you like. The egg fragments, beautifully broken, not sort of, whether this is a typical breakage pattern of a hatched egg in a clutch with some that weren't. So this is the type of work I'm sure all of you who've been in the field with me know that this is what I do. Walk up and down, logging this is now a 1645, 1845. So it's logging every 50 centimeters, making a stratigraphic and a sedimentological log. This is mostly sedimentological. I'm looking at the lithologies and the sedimentary structures, and of course where all the fossils are, and all the mottling, and all of the trace fossils, all the root marks, all the evidence of paleosoils, as well as the burrows, underground burrows, and nesting sites. Lots of information that can reconstruct what it was like on that land surface 235 million years ago. That's a sort of detailed log. And also some actuopaleontology, if you like. This is where we look at modern environments to get a key to the past. The present is a key to the past, which is a famous quote. And there's a nice similarity in the mode of nesting site of the rhea, the present-day rhea, with those Patagonian dinosaurs, in that they are in depressions in the ground. They are not blind. There's no evidence of nesting material. There's no evidence of vegetation preferentially matted into the base of the nest. And the nests are full of broken eggshell from hatched eggs. Look at the breakage shell. Oh, I can help you to look at the breakage patterns with Mosaurus nests and with Rhea's nests. Incidentally, that looks like a predation mark there. That looks like a beak impression. So there is obviously one of the reasons why these didn't hatch would be predation in this sort of way. But normally, that sort of style of predation would break the shell open because they are clearly looking for the embryo. So not all the breakage can be necessarily due to hatched eggs. They can be due to predation. We all realize that. But there's a rhea. That's the animal that was laying these eggs. And so there are some nice similarities. And this actually has a very male oriented. The males actually bring up the infants, and they have one hole in the ground where many females lay their eggs in one hole, and the male protects the infants from then on. So that's an interesting behavior, and somehow some sort of interesting analogies with the sort of behavior we're looking at reconstructing for the Mosaurus. There's a rhea's foot. Unfortunately, I didn't see any live rheas close enough to photograph, so that's as close as you get to a rhea. Not only dead, it's desiccated. But that's a rhea foot. I did mention some juvenile aggregations, and this is the excavation in which now 8 juvenile Mosaurus have been found in a single nodule going down into the going down at an angle into the rock, and it is compelling evidence for juvenile aggregation and compelling evidence that it is underground aggregation rather than on surface. So, because this this layer is going at an angle down into the rock. We're still, Patagonian team is still excavating this. They've already taken out a bit from here and started preparing it, and it's got eight juveniles in it, and all different states of they're lying one on top of each other. They're not all on the same horizon. They're not intercurled, but they are lying in alignment. They're all lying in the same direction. This guy's quite an athlete, but not soon after his exploits here, he ended up falling on his knees and cutting himself open. I've got a nice picture of that. So, but yeah, the excavation material. These are very you know. They're testosterone-driven students here, so there's lots of energy devoted to using the rock hammers and everything, so they love it. That's one of the excavation sites. We've been working all the way around here, found many. I can't remember how many that need to be excavated, but that's a typical excavation with the plastered jacket now over the fossil bones. That can then be lifted into the vehicle. So it's tell you, it needs a lot of muscle to be doing this, and it really is a job for these sort of guys, you know. My job was to map all the occurrences of surface bone in that whole area, and to taphonomically assess it. So this is a typical surface occurrence of bone of one of the large dinosaurs. You can't tell right now, but just to give you an indication of what the wind abrasion on this surface has created, has not actually created these grooves. The grooves were there, but it's accentuated them. But some of the wind abrasion on the long bones, this gives you an indication of growth rings within the long bones of the dinosaur. This is obviously a very nice indication of seasonal growth, so that there was times which the dinosaurs were growing fast, not only in the inner cortex, these large lines of arrested growth here. So growth, arrested growth. So they are, of course, reconstructed as being at least maybe partially warm-blooded, but mostly ectotherms. And the ectothermic, this is typical of ectothermic type of growth. And, of course, its growth spurts are linked to seasonal warmness. And other lines of arrested growth within females especially are linked to egg laying. So there's lots of lovely histology in this bone. There's no doubt there's plenty more forensic work to be done on these skeletons. There's a nice indication of when you start to get your eye in. You know, this is after a week or so you start to find stuff like this. This is an elbow. This is the humerus, radius, and ulna. And that's there. That's what you could spot. But that is an elbow of an unexhumed juvenile dinosaur, juvenile Mosaurus probably, but until it's dug out, we can't tell. It has been uncovered now, and it is a complete skeleton. So, and that's done in these sort of conditions. It's really difficult to show wind on a slide, but this wind is so cold that Claudia had to hold on to anything that was not flying around, because she actually got blown over. She's so light. She really had difficulty in walking upright. Some of the local wildlife, which is around with us, I'm not sure if the taxa here, maybe some herpetologists around could help me out. And maybe Amish can help me on that. And the vegetation is well adapted to the environment, but clearly adapted to the wind effect over there. The grasses, seasonal grasses. And the pangolin, lovely stuff. We managed to catch one live one, lots of dead ones. It's obviously predated by the raptors, the condors and things like that. There's a nice pangolin skull which now is on my bedside table, so that I wake up to this every morning. the sky, the sky at night doesn't change from the day, it just goes red. Those clouds are still like that, they're still streaking, that wispy, cotton woolly type thing is a typical Patagonian's night. And, there's the guy, we had to get him stitched up. He's actually removing the stitches right here, so... But this guy is an Argentinian, and he's also a poet, and he kept writing poetry in his... he writes love poems, you know, and that's in his little book, and he would sit in the evening writing love poems, but he never would read them to us, and so he did let me photograph them, so if anyone could tell me what this says, it would be... might not be so good, actually. But we catered for ourselves inside the farmhouse. We were able to get a gas cooker going, gas fridges and things, and of course enough ice for the gin and tonic. And the cooking was done by us all. Claudia is an excellent cook, but the Argentinian braise, something else. So there's that's actually the horse that we saw outside. That's the bit that we had. You know, we were going to eat. That's what we had to eat, that and some other stuff, along with some really nice local food. Braai Master, of course. But the Argentinian braai is done long and slow, but still over coals. It's very similar to the way we do it, but usually just a lot longer with these rib cuts and things. So it's a brilliant tradition, of course. And we ate outside in the braai area of that, out of the wind, because the main thing is you can eat outside when you get out of the wind. That's a big problem. Some of the evening festivities. This is a Brazilian guy. He was the only guy who would own up to all his infidelities. So we would sit and listen to his stories. And the more he drank, the more his stories. And of course, they were totally unbelievable. But it was good entertaining. And of course, he didn't partake in the excavation the next day. He was out. But as I said, my mate, I became as much a mate drinker as the rest. So along with the others, I was a pretty good adopted Argentinian. So at the end of the trip, that's now our first phase of the trip. It's obviously a successful trip, but just to see how much we'd got done. We did find Bonaparte's egg site, and we did find more eggs, in fact, a lot more than he had found. We found shell fragment accumulations, which looked like hatched nests, so we can start to not just look at whole eggs as a way of finding out how many nests there were on any single landscape. We did find those two different sized taxa. So that's interesting that Mosasaurus wasn't the only dinosaur nesting in this site. And the juveniles, the eight juveniles, were very close by in an underground burrow. So we do think this is a regular breeding ground for Mosasaurus and others. We've yet to find all the others. We've got two different sizes of eggs, and maybe three. The detailed stratigraphic and sedimentological sections, that all goes towards interpreting the depositional environment. At the moment, we can say the eggs were laid in windblown sand, in windblown dust, in a sparsely vegetated area near a lakeshore, an alkaline lakeshore, under a semi-arid climate. That's as far as we can go so far. Obviously, we can get a bit better once we find more sites and more vegetation. I'm particularly interested to see how close to vegetation these nesting sites were. And we've also found now this first body fossils of a mid-Triassic theropod in Patagonia, and that still has to be excavated. So that's identified mainly on the laterally compressed vertebrae and thick-walled limb bones. This is the team, fantastic group of students, and thanks to Diego Pol, of course, for inviting me, the Trelew Museum for all the students, and the logistical support and National Geographic Society. Thank you very much. What do I think they were? I suspect that they are plateosaurus, and that is that's what. I was lucky it didn't happen to me. And that's what would confirm the Middle Triassic Age. That's what we have in South Africa, and it's also been found in Tanzania, the plateosaurus. So it would make sense that that animal was fairly cosmopolitan over the southern Gondwana at that time. It walked everywhere at that time. But the if it's Musaurus, then it would fit as being the adult size of Musaurus. If we look at the infant, the embryo of Massaspondylus, have you seen our dinosaur display here, where there's an embryo of Massaspondylus? If you look at the ratio between the embryo and the adult, you are definitely in that sort of size. It's at least sort of 400 or 500 times bigger than. So then we can expect the adult Bosaurus to be considerably larger than the I guess the
what was the question?
The question was, have I any thoughts on how the eggs died, and in fact how the juveniles died as well? The one indication is from the buryings, the material that actually buries the eggs is windblown dust. It is what we call loess. The material it is buried in is also loess. So the dinosaurs were going to sites where windblown dust was accumulating. Now, it's generally a site which has not got vegetation. So the idea then is that they were using that as an incubation site. So it was allowing the eggs to be buried, but buried, you know, under the surface, but still get heat from the sun. But when you bury that too deeply, you actually throttle the embryos. You can create the whole diffusion will not work, and you can poison the embryos. If you bury it under another layer of about that much of silt. Loess is windblown silt. It's tiny, it's much finer grained than sand, but it's coarser grained than clay. So it's a particular grain size. But so that is the current hypothesis, that there was a time when this breeding ground was killed by silt. But the next season they just came back and buried and laid in that very stuff. So it was this very stuff that they needed to incubate was also at times when the silt came in at the wrong time of the year, before hatching, then it would kill it. Yo.
Do you have any vegetarians in your group?
No, certainly it's very I haven't met an Argentinian vegetarian.
Roger, you mentioned partial warm-blooded. What
yes.
do you mean by that?
Well, yeah, there's a state of warm-bloodedness or bodily control of your core temperature, which is sort of partially induced by your physiology, but also behaviorally. So they call it poikilotherms, or basically. So there is a way of controlling your core temperature by just going in and out of the ground, for instance. But there is another very primitive form of homeothermy by sort of a primitive shivering type of response, which will keep up the core temperatures. Whether these dinosaurs were able to do that is why we're looking at the histology of the bone. I very much, from what I can see, it doesn't look like the prosauropods were doing it. Perhaps the theropods were, though. Theropods being, of course, the ancestors of birds, and birds, of course, now are homeothermic. And when homeothermy actually started in theropods is linked to the evolution of feathers in theropods. We don't put feathers on this theropod. It's not generally regarded as these large ones didn't have an insulating layer. So that's why I say possibly partial homeothermic, because the idea that all dinosaurs were cold-blooded is a bit old-fashioned, you know, because they did move around. They did move quite fast. In from their trackways, we could see that they are running, you know, and to even for a cold-blooded animal to be running at that speed that you can work out from their trackways means that they had a physiology which would allow that to happen. And so core temperature stability is what I mean by partial homeothermic.
The two adults passing away together, if that's an unnatural death, do you know, I'm guessing it's an unnatural death because they both expired at a similar time. Yeah. Do you have any ideas what could cause that?
I absolutely don't. Except, let's say, because of the setting, because of the attitude, I just got a feeling that poisoning might be a possibility. When there are drought deaths, they don't normally die together, sort of thing. But there's no evidence of miring. There's no evidence of getting stuck there, lying on the same surface, but it's not stuck in there. Associated sediment is showing this alkalinity, so it's possible that poisoning in an algal bloom type poisoning could kill off the stuff that is around a water body. But that scenario. What we would need to find is a lot more other things, other animals, because it wouldn't just be sauropods that got poisoned. So we would need to find a whole range of that. So, no, I don't know what caused them, and I really don't know why they're lying so close together.
Sort of clung to the bed.
Yes, possibly. Possibly they appear to be the same sex, you know, but let's see. That sort of sparring scenario, it's unlikely that both would fight to the death. You know, but,
and Roger, thanks so much for another fabulous lecture.
And I'm sorry about the start, but let's hope you haven't spoiled it.
Thank you.